With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there and welcome to Stock Club, a podcast brought to you by My Wall Street. I'm James and joining me on today's episode are Anne-Marie and Rory from the My Wall Street analyst team. Today, we're talking about what will happen if Elon Musk actually buys Twitter, why Netflix thinks it will lose 2 million subscribers this quarter, and the hottest new social media app on the market, Be Real. So Rory, Anne-Marie, welcome back to this week's Stock Club podcast. Before we kick off, I just want to remind listeners at home that we now have an extended version of Stock Club that you can listen to in the My Wall Street app exclusively. This is completely free to listen to. All you need to do is download the My Wall Street app and set up your free account. You can easily find all the past episodes of Stock Club there and get notified as soon as new episodes are posted. What we'll feature in this extended episode this week is an extended elevator pitch where we'll discuss one of the pitches that either Rory or Anne-Marie pitched to me. And we'll go through it and figure out if it's a good investment or not. So make sure to jump on over to the My Wall Street app if you want to listen to that extended pitch. But guys, another week, another story involving Elon Musk and Twitter. I don't think we can really escape this. Anyone listened to last week's podcast will know that just before we went to publish it, news emerged that Elon Musk had submitted an offer to buy Twitter for about $54 a share, which would have valued the company, or which does value the company, at around $43 billion. This revelation had come after Musk initially revealed a 9.2% stake in the company, which made him the largest individual shareholder by a long shot. And then he said he was joining the board, and then he said he wasn't joining the board. There was this big to and fro. Rory, we talked about this up until the point where Musk offered to buy the company. We spoke extensively about it last week, but you were on your holidays, you know, you were there relaxing, and you probably got a push notification off My Wall Street itself saying that Musk had put in an offer for Twitter. What did you make of this? Were you surprised to see that he'd put out this offer?
I mean, considering Musk is a person who has built an entire business persona and see by the likes of a personal persona on being shocking, I suppose it's one of those things where it's like you're initially shocked and then you realize, why was I shocked at all?
Yeah.
it's his whole raison d'etre is to be as shocking and as he possibly can. So you're kind of always, I suppose, trying to kind of play 4D chess with yourself when you're trying to analyze what Elon's doing, because you have to take what you originally think and then you have to go, well, no, hold on, that's not what he would want me to think. So therefore I have to, it's kind of a game of poker where is he doing it three times? So was I shocked? It's hard to really judge emotions at the moment. I mean, he's always been aggressive as a kind of deal maker as well. You know, if we look back on, you know, the SolarCity acquisition, his dealings with the SEC, his response to any criticism whatsoever, he always behaves aggressively back. So, you know, you could say I was shocked by how quickly he made the offer, given that the story was kind of still kind of developing. But then again, it's Elon. Well, you know, he could be doing anything. Is it surprising that a rich megalomaniac wants to own the kind of modern equivalent of a mass media newspaper? No, it's not surprising at all. It's no more shocking than Bezos wanting to own the Washington Post, or Rupert Murdoch wanting to own Fox News, or Mark Zuckerberg wanting to own the entire metaverse, whatever that is. Or
yeah.
Logan Roy wanting to own ATN. You know, it's just part of the checklist, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you said it's no surprise that Elon Musk wants to own something like Twitter, but I suppose the question I have is, how genuine do you think this offer actually is? You know, he's well known for trolling. And as we record right now, Twitter shares are hovering around $47 a share, which to me might suggest that the market isn't as convinced that this deal is going to happen as we might think.
Well, I mean, if the board accepts his offer, I think he's going to have to go through with it. There's still an awful lot of questions surrounding this offer. It was, I think the exact amount he offered was $54.20, which is, because, you know, 420 is is some sort of magical number to him. And guess what today is? The day we're recording is 420. And he's been leaving what some people have called cryptic tweets up about what he's going to do. They're not that cryptic at all. Like, you know, saying tender is the night, love me tender. So he's definitely hinting that he is going to make some move in the next couple of days. We don't know, you know, how he's going to finance this to begin with. Obviously, he's a very wealthy man, but he doesn't have $46 billion in cash lying around. The vast majority of his wealth is tied up in Tesla shares. I think someone figured he'd have to sell a fifth of those in order to fund this acquisition. I mean, that could have really devastating consequences for Tesla, Tesla shareholders.
I was going to say, would you be worried if you were a Tesla shareholder now seeing this?
Well, I mean, considering a huge percentage of Tesla's current valuation is tied up in Musk's participation in the business, I don't think any single corporate leader would have a bigger impact on a business if they were to sell that fast, that amount of shares. There's also the possibility that, you know, he goes in with someone else. His criticisms of the board could be met with, you know, some friendly offers from the likes of Silver Lake or Elliott Management. Or, I mean, Elliott Management are probably pretty pissed off at the way that the kind of power he's exerted, given that it took them years to try and get anything out of the board. But I think Apollo Management as well have said that they could potentially fund something along these lines. I think, you know, in general, he is serious about this. Don't hold me to this. But I think he is serious about the concept of Twitter, and he has ideas for it. And I think he probably got to a point where he thought he was going to buy a large percentage of the shares and exert some influence, but has probably realized since then that really he wants to kind of own the whole thing. And that could mean that, you know, the changes that maybe he thinks are necessary for it can't be made when the company is a public company. And I kind of probably agree with him on that. There's things that they probably should have done a long time ago that they haven't been able to do because they're kind of constantly in the public spotlight. I think, you know, his criticisms of the board can be, you know, fair at times. And I know Jack Dorsey has come out and kind of hinted that he would support that too. So I do think there is a seriousness about this, and it could be as kind of petty as the fact that it's his platform. He's built a business and a fortune using this platform as a kind of public mouthpiece, and he doesn't want it to go down a particular route.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned the board there, and the board, you know, they were happy to have Elon on, it seemed, about a week ago onto the board. But now it seems there's been a lot of talk about them enacting this so-called poison pill to stop him taking over more control of the company. Can you quickly explain what this idea of a poison pill is in terms of Elon and taking over Twitter?
Yeah, I mean, I can't explain exactly what a poison pill is, because it's a kind of legal process that could take many forms. But essentially, there's loads of different ways that someone could take over a public business. In a typical scenario, if you control 51% of the voting power, you control the company. So you've got 51% of the voting power, you just pack the board of directors with your buddies. They'll vote for whatever you tell them to vote for, and it's the business is yours essentially, and you can do all sorts of nefarious things when you have that kind of power in a business, including kind of screwing over a lot of other shareholders by, you know, merging with a business that you own for much less than the business is worth, etc. And so now that's not always the case. There's legal provisions that'll be written into shareholder agreements, but in the most simple cases, that's the way it goes. And so the vast majority of the time, someone who's trying to take over business will try and kind of get the board of directors on their side. So they'll approach them, they'll suggest a takeover, there'll be a bit of negotiation about the price. You know, the board will try and find one that they think is fair to everyone. And then the board will accept it. And at that point, they'll submit that offer to the shareholders for their approval. However, in the past, there were a lot more kind of hostile types of takeovers, kind of thinking back, especially kind of like to the 80s. We had all these kind of corporate raiders that were using a lot of tactics that could essentially force a takeover, which was not equitable to all shareholders. And at times could hold shareholders essentially at random, trying to pit them against each other, trying to pit them against the board. And so this concept of a poison pill which is an illegal term, it's called a shareholders' rights plan, is a tactic that boards use. Well, they actually never use them really, but they can. All they need to do is threaten to use them, and that prevents something like this happening. And the basic way it would work is the board decides, well, we don't want this person owning too much of our company. So let's say they reach a certain threshold of shares. You know, if they own, if, as soon as they reach 20%, we are going to give every shareholder except that person a free share for every share they own.
Okay.
So it's essentially like a stock split, except one person in particular doesn't get to participate. in this case, it would be Elon Musk. So they could decide, you know, when Elon owns 14.2% of the business, because, you know, that 420 has to feature into everything. They could decide that they're going to, or let's say he owns 20% of the business, they're going to like give every other Twitter shareholder a free share, and then suddenly he owns 10% of the business. So
yeah,
he's practically lost half his money. And so that's kind of, I mean, it's never, I think I'm correct in saying it's never been used, because just the threat of it itself is enough to deter this stuff. But someone could check me on that.
I don't imagine things like that deterring Elon Musk either, for some reason. So yeah, look, I'm very conscious we're recording this Wednesday afternoon. It's very likely by the time this goes out on Friday, something else mad will happen. So I want both of you guys to give me a prediction. What do you think? How do you think this saga is going to end? What do you see the end game here? Anne-Marie, what's your end game with this Twitter Elon Musk 420 dog's dinner of a story?
I think Elon turns around and he buys Pinterest. I think that's it. He just goes, he says, you know what? Free speech is aesthetic photos. And he will buy Pinterest and that'll be the end of it. And all of his tweets from then on will just be captions under photos of like Teslas and
quotes.
Meme dogs. Yeah, there you go.
Okay, I like that. Rory, what about you?
I mean, I think the reasonable thing that would happen is that Elon kind of, you know, influences some power in his current position, because he does have a lot of power. Remember, like he did say that offer was his final offer and he was going to have to reconsider his stake in the company. I mean, if he reconsiders his stake in the company, by which I mean, I think he means selling all his shares, that would be bad for shareholders. So he's kind of holding on a gun at shareholders' heads right now. I think, you know, the reasonable thing to happen with that, he would kind of get a little bit of what he wants, maybe a kind of shake above the board, maybe kind of some commitments in terms of this free speech route that he's going down, which is just so boring. I really thought Elon would be a bit more inventive in his bullshit reasons to buy a business, and there'll be some sort of, you know, equitable agreement, but who knows? This could be all over by the time this goes out anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Let's move on then. And on this podcast, we've been speaking quite a bit about Netflix recently. But I think after the company's earnings report last night, which is Tuesday evening this week, I think it's worth going back to chat about the company again. So Netflix's share price absolutely cratered on Tuesday night after reporting a loss of 200,000 subscribers in the most recent quarter, which is the first time the company has actually lost subscribers in more than a decade. Even worse than this, the company is projecting a loss of 2 million subscribers in the current quarter, which is quarter two of the fiscal year. Netflix blamed a couple of things on this miss, including a high household penetration of the service, the sharing of account password words, which is something we talked about recently, and the pull forward experience during COVID, which I think is just an excuse a lot of companies pull out. Anne-Marie, you've been doing a lot of research on Netflix and the kind of wider streaming industry recently. What do you make of this miss for Netflix? Was it a shock, or was it something we should have kind of expected?
In terms of kind of subscribers, I think it was a shock. We knew subscriber numbers were going to slow down and we're coming off the pandemic. Netflix actually predicted that last quarter when they set Q1 guidance to only 2 million subscribers. And even that like was a headline grabber and punished the stock, as it would actually make it Netflix's slowest quarter since like 2011 or something like that. So we kind of knew it was coming. We just didn't know how bad it was going to be. Mm. And I guess it's also worth mentioning that they lost 200,000 subscribers, but that does include a loss of 700,000 subscribers in Russia, which the company made the decision to churn those users and it departed the country altogether. So if we remove Russia, I guess they actually would have had a net add of 500,000 subscribers, but I don't really think that's a consolation at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, and really kind of where we saw the declines is where you'd expect if the argument is, oh, this is due to inflation, this is due to people, you know, struggling to make ends meet. So we saw a decline in users in the United States and Canada and in Europe and the Middle East. However, we also actually saw a minor decline in Latin America, which I was a bit bummed out about. I think I and a lot of analysts would consider Latin America to be somewhat of a frontier for streaming right now. As internet penetration increases in that region, it's kind of a great battleground for people to try and get in and make your streaming service the main one for people there. And so to see an incremental loss there was a bit of a bummer, but I assume that that's going to be an issue we'll have going forward because of, you know, lower household incomes and economic instability and the prevalence of ad-supported streaming in that region. But I mean, it wasn't all doom and gloom in terms of subscribers. We did see in the Asia-Pacific region, they added a little under 1 million subscribers, which is pretty good. I would argue that is somewhat evidence that Netflix's localization strategy is still working. And that growth was in line with where they were growing in the Asia-Pacific region last year. So they are adding subscribers. They're just obviously not adding them in the way which we would like. And I guess it's worth mentioning if we zoom out from subscriber numbers, and I would do this solely because I saw like a tweet from a Netflix investor, and he was like, if Netflix never released subscriber figures, and you just looked at it from a dollar and cents perspective, it actually wasn't a terrible quarter in terms of revenue, operating margin, and EPS. They all looked pretty solid, just pretty good, like single digit growth that you'd expect to see from a company entering maturity. EPS in particular was pretty strong. It was $3.53, which was against an estimate of $2.89. So that was pretty good. And also Netflix conducted some surveying that's worth mentioning that showed that they're actually not losing watch time to their competition. So like they're not being diminished by Disney Plus or Amazon Prime or anything like that. People are just watching more hours of television on streaming altogether. So Netflix still controls 6.4% of total TV time, and that's actually up a bit from 2021. But obviously watch time doesn't really translate into revenue. It just kind of proves that people like your product. So I guess it's now the pressure's on Netflix to find a way to add new customers or better monetize the ones that they have.
Yeah, what I thought was really interesting about this report was the mention again of this planned crackdown on password sharing. So in the shareholder letter, management estimated that in addition to the 222 million paying households Netflix has, there's Netflix passwords are being shared with over 100 million additional households. So, you know, almost a third of people using the platform aren't paying for it, potentially. Netflix have been talking about this crackdown on password sharing more and more over the last few months, and it's becoming pretty clear why, I suppose. How are they going to realistically crack down on this? Is there any way for the company to actually, you know, stop people sharing passwords?
I mean, considering Netflix has talked about it so much, I would assume that they have an ability to figure out when an account is being used by more than one household. Like maybe you'll have to register the devices you're going to use it on, and once it surpasses a certain number, you may not be allowed anymore. Or like simple geography is probably enough. Like I use my parents' Netflix account and I live in Ireland and they live in Colorado. So surely Netflix knows that like we're not a single household anymore.
But I think really hope Netflix doesn't go the Google or the Gmail route. You know, when you try to sign into your Gmail from another device,
yeah,
and it's sort of like Google kicks
off
your
an alarm
door.
Yeah, and they send you like a very detailed map on your phone and they're like, did you just log in from this exact GPS coordinate? And you're like, yes, that
potentially.
Yeah, I think the real question though we kind of have to answer is how do you monetize these users in such a way that they don't churn? And that's like a very delicate equation. Like Netflix offers you the content library, they offer you the originals, and it probably has the best streaming infrastructure. We've talked about this in the past. Like I saw a TikTok recently of this girl who found the Disney Plus TV app so cumbersome to operate that she would just search for what she wanted to watch on her phone and then cast it to her TV because she just found it too annoying to search for anything on that app. And I think Netflix has done a much better job with these type of small detail things that just really enhance the viewer experience. But the question is like, how much pricing power is there in this model? And I don't know. I would like to believe that Netflix has this first mover advantage and has enough of a defined streaming brand to be the subscription that you never cancel. You know, it's the equivalent of basic cable and all other streaming platforms are just kind of an add-on. And I think when Squid Game came out, we almost saw that idea of this brand was emerging that was powerful and created great content. And when you saw it was a Netflix original, you just assumed it would be good and you would watch it. You know, we talk about Disney sometimes, and so much of the thesis for investing in Disney is the strength of the brand. When you see something that's made by Disney, you know it'll be great for your kids, it'll be family friendly, it'll be good. And I think Netflix now has built that kind of brand, but I don't really know how much that brand is worth. And I do think it is kind of the baseline for streaming. And we do have some evidence of that. We recently saw a report from Kantar World Panel, which publishes an annual entertainment on-demand report for the UK. And it found that cancellation rates just across the board for streaming services declined. But the one that was least impacted was Netflix and Amazon Prime, and they labeled them kind of the last to go services, which is a testament to the diversity of content and how people view these. But I guess kind of beyond simple monetization of freeloaders, I would expect to see Netflix maybe building out some more product offerings. I'm interested to see where gaming will go, as well as maybe some more interactive content and maybe even some in-person showings with the release of Genius, Y-U-H-S, which is that Kanye West documentary that came out a while ago. Netflix permitted a one-week theatrical release, which was the first time they'd done so for a movie that wasn't up for Oscar consideration. So if Netflix is going to build out these spectacle films that we've become accustomed to because of Marvel, which they may well do, they have a huge contract with Christopher Nolan, those projects should be in theaters, and that, you know, could be a huge additional revenue stream for them if they allow it to be in a theater exclusive for 4 weeks or something like that. So we're really in this period that's going to test Netflix's innovative spirit and their management, because I think they have a brand that people love, and they've always said that they won't add advertising. So now is kind of the time to have some creative thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. For a deeper discussion, that gaming Netflix thing, I'd recommend going back, listen to that podcast we had with Aaron Bush 2 or 3 weeks ago. Really, really interesting perspectives on where Netflix could go with that gaming side of their business. But after Netflix's report on Tuesday, shares in other streaming services fell as well. So from what you're saying there, it doesn't seem fair to say, or it seems fair to say, excuse me, that this is kind of an industry headwind rather than a Netflix-specific headwind we're seeing.
Yeah, the story's definitely bigger than Netflix. It just impacts them the most because they're kind of the dedicated streamer, whereas the other big players tend to be diversified across some of the verticals. It also doesn't help that Netflix reports first out the gate, so they tend to somewhat set the mood for the coming quarter. I think we're definitely going to be in the next kind of 6 months to a year that's really going to test the new coming streamers. That same survey that I referenced earlier that was done in the UK found that churn rates for Disney Plus in the first quarter for 2022 more than tripled and reached 12%.
Wow.
Which, that's pretty bad. And I base it on a pure assumption here. I would blame this on the lack of new releases for adults that Disney Plus has. We've seen them kind of pivot their streaming marketing strategy around this recently. They have all these billboards up in Dublin, and I saw them even, I was in Croatia recently, they had billboards there, and they've labeled themselves the home of the expected and the unexpected, which is them trying to maybe move themselves away from, oh, we just do Marvel or we just do Pixar. And so it'll be interesting to see how that works in terms of trying to add more adult users, particularly with the upcoming integration of 20th Century Fox. So yeah, I think it's going to be a difficult year for streamers. I think we should maybe keep our eyes on them, and it might be, you know, the kind of time to readjust our attention to ad supported streaming, which may benefit in the next kind of 12 months. So yeah, it's going to be rough, but I'm interested to see kind of what the players do about it. I know Disney has announced that they'll be adding ad supported streaming. So it'll be interesting to see if Netflix will continue to say, no, we're not adding ads, and this is how we're going to monetize in the future.
What do you think, Rory? Do you expect to see ads on Netflix anytime soon?
I've always been kind of hopeful that they wouldn't go down that route. And because one of the reasons why is because it was almost this kind of philosophical battle between kind of ad supported versus the idea that people actually, you know, are intelligent beings who don't want to be advertised at all the time. We'd rather pay for good content. And I think Netflix was kind of at the forefront. I suppose HBO was really as well, but Netflix, in terms of kind of like an internet company, was very much at the forefront of that, of that push. And so it feels like we're kind of losing the battle somewhat slightly. On the flip side, I do think, you know, if they're going down the kind of, if they're going to cut off a lot of these password sharers, these
freeloaders,
freeloaders, then, you know, I suppose giving them a kind of, I suppose, more of a kind of soft landing with a $5-6 ad supported version is probably better than trying to pull them over to the, what is it in the US, $15-16.
Absolutely. I would just like to confirm as well that 2 out of 3 of us here pay for our Netflix account.
In my defense, I pay for Amazon Prime, and they get to use my Amazon Prime, and I use their Netflix.
Oh yeah. Right. Oh yeah.
Thieves everywhere. Den of thieves.
So let's move on. And don't forget that if you listen to this podcast in the My Wall Street app, you get some extra member only content at the end. For the past few weeks, I've been picking my favorite elevator pitch, and the three of us then go on to discuss the company in more depth and figure out if it's a good investment or not. It's completely free to listen to episodes of Stock Club in the My Wall Street app. All you have to do is create a My Wall Street account. And if that wasn't enough, we also have a brand new podcast series which went live last weekend called FML Fund My Life. This is a podcast that makes investing seem more approachable, easy, and something you can actually enjoy, creating a community for novice investors to ask questions and feel supported in their investing journey. Anne-Marie, what did you and Nicole chat about in the first episode last weekend?
So we talked about the first stock that we ever bought after we joined My Wall Street and kind of the lessons that we learned and the mistakes that we made. And then that kind of set us up for episode two to talk about if we were to start our investing journey all over again, what stocks would we pick and why? I know. Unfortunately, actually, Nicole's first stock was Netflix. So
tough one.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll cut that out. So if you want to listen into FML, you can find a link in the notes for today's show or simply just search for it on your favorite podcasting platform. That's coming out every 2 weeks, Anne-Marie, I believe. Is that right?
Yep, that's correct.
Cool.
Has anyone checked in on Emmett actually today? I haven't heard from him all day.
Yeah, he did. Did you see he sent a message to us on Slack that just said FML and then nothing else?
He was talking about the podcast, surely.
Yeah, he was talking about your podcast. So let's just check in on him. I think he has a prominent stake in that business.
Emmett, if you're listening, let us know you're okay. So let's move on. Instead of the mailbag this week, let's look at some of the more recent insights we've written for the My Wall Street app and chat about them in a little more detail. Anne-Marie, I want to come to a piece you wrote this Wednesday about the changing face of social media landscape. And there's one new app in particular you're writing about that's really changing the way people think about social media. I believe this app is called Be Real.
It is, yeah. It's called Be Real. It's French. I'm sure, you know, every great company comes from France.
So is it actually pronounced Be Real or is it like Be Real? Belial.
I don't know. I went on their website and like they're such a new company that a portion of their website is just hosted on Notion. And I was like, well, we're still in the development phase. Yeah, but I kind of wrote this article at the beginning of the year where I talked about upcoming social media trends. And I noticed that particularly young people seem to be regressing back towards kind of privacy and authenticity and kind of only wanting to be in group chats. They didn't seem to want to be exposed to 1,000 people when they put up a photo. And in my view, this meant that Instagram was a bit at risk, particularly because when Gen Z kids were using Instagram, it was in a way that was very contrary to the monetization strategy that Instagram has been moving towards, in which they prioritize video content over photos. But all these Gen Z kids, they were still posting big clumps of like kind of unflattering, authentic, unfiltered photos, and they would call them photo dumps. And I was going, if Instagram can't recognize the fact that Gen Z is using this still as a photo sharing service, they're going to get disrupted. Someone else is going to come along and take this market away from them. So I've been on the hunt for an upcoming social media that was photo-based. And I kind of found them, actually, via TikTok because I saw all these teenagers. They would be like sitting in front of the Eiffel Tower and they'd make this TikTok where they'd go, if my Be Real doesn't come on right now, I'm going to be fuming. I'm going to be so mad if Be Real doesn't notify me right now. And I was like, what the hell is Be Real? So I Googled it and I found out it's this social media app that was founded in 2020 by this guy named Alexis Barat. And he founded it because he hated social media and he was like, it's addictive. You waste time there and it's really hard to actually interact with your friends. So he said he was going to make a new social media and he made this social media called Be Real. And all it does is you add your friends on it. And then once a day at a random time, Be Real sends you a push notification. And it's the same for all the users who use it. And it gives you 2 minutes to take and post a photo using both the front and back camera. And basically the app is hoping to catch you off guard. It's hoping that you are forced to document just like your regular everyday life, like riding the bus or, you know, going to work or just walking around or whatever. And then after you post and only after you post, you're allowed to view the posts of your friends and the people who opt to share publicly via the discovery feed. And so it kind of gets everyone involved in this social media in a way that like everybody looks terrible together. So no one can be glorified. And it kind of, truthfully, it seems like they don't have any of the kind of anonymous harassment that you would get on Facebook or Instagram because everyone has to post photos. So it's like, well, I can't make fun of them because they can also see me.
Yeah.
And it's this really interesting concept. And I read a bunch of interviews of people who use it, and it's spreading like crazy on college campuses in the US. They have 2 million daily active users right now. Their downloads are up like almost 400% this year. They're doing really, really well. But all their users were kind of like, I really like it. I just add like 40 or 50 of my friends, and we just get to post silly photos every day, and we just comment on each other's photos and check in with each other and see what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I thought it was this very interesting kind of more authentic private social media that is taking advantage of all these trends that we saw upcoming. That being said, I have absolutely no idea how to monetize this, and I don't know how it'll be a business, but it was cool to see.
When you say it's going to catch you off guard, I mean, that could end up being a bit of a tricky spot. I mean, I hope Jeffrey Toobin's not on it.
Well, you can post late, so it gives you the 2-minute window, but if you post late, then your post gets like watermarked that they posted late. So your friends could be like,
it's like a shame tag.
Yeah, it's like, why did you wait 45 minutes to post? Did you go and find somewhere more beautiful to stand? So, yeah.
But I think that's a good point though, Anne-Marie, about, you know, how are they going to monetize this? It doesn't seem like, I know, you know, when you mentioned that it's taking off around college campuses, straight away you think of the likes of Facebook, the likes mm-hmm. of Match, you know, a lot of really great tech and particularly social innovations have, you know, come from the hotbed of college campuses. But, you know, what's the end game here? If this is the anti-social media, surely not going to sell data. They're surely not going to put advertising in. So is social media going to lose its appeal to big advertisers or to people looking for those big returns?
Well, it seems that, like, I have seen one company so far, which is Chipotle, and Chipotle tweeted yesterday, so Tuesday, that they were joining Be Real, and then Be Real tweeted them back and kind of gave a scrunched face emoji. That was all they responded with. So I think Be Real was kind of upset. I think they were like, no, you're a company, don't join our social media. So I have followed Chipotle, and I will keep you updated on what their Be Real presence looks like. But yeah, I don't think it's like a space that will be friendly to companies. It's not an advertiser-friendly space. And quite frankly, the guy who founded Be Real shows no interest in trying to like make it an advertiser space or make it something that people use consistently that you could make a bunch of money out of. Like, their server was down a couple days ago and they just tweeted, our server's down, sorry, go spend more time with your friends, you're welcome, and that was it. And like, nothing. Yeah, they were like, oops, we don't care, go outside.
What, does he just want the world to burn? He doesn't want to make money? What is it?
I know.
Those people don't exist in this world, come on.
So I was like, maybe he'll charge people $1 a month. She said, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of like we're in this social experiment, and like the company is hiring like crazy, but they've only done one funding round. They made $30 million in their Series A funding round. That was a couple months ago. That's all they've done. So I don't really know where this company is going, but it's like a very interesting like social experiment to show, hey, like people just want a space to like check in with their friends. They don't want to be harangued by advertisement every time they scroll. So I'm very interested in it. I'm interested to see where it goes. That being said, I did also see a girl tweet, and she said, I used to live Wordle to Wordle, and now I live Be Real to Be Real. So, like, maybe the whole thing will be dead in 4 weeks. I don't know. I'll keep you updated.
Is Wordle dead? I'm still on Wordle.
Yeah, but, like, this girl was, like, 19, so I think she was a bit quicker to the social transformation.
They're afraid of commitment, these young people. That's the problem.
Yeah.
How long is your Wordle streak now, Rory?
I think I'm on 79.
Pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah. My average, more than my top one is in 3 guesses, which I'm very proud of.
Okay. Not too bad. So we can expect Rory to be on Be Real in about 4 years' time.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks for that. So if you want to read that full insight with a few more details about the kind of wider social media landscape, you can check that out in My Wall Street right now. Let's move on to the elevator pitch, my favorite part of the show. So I just ask you guys to pitch me a company that's on your watch list at the moment. 30 to 60 second pitches, please. And I'm going to pick my favorite that we'll go into more detail on. Anne-Marie, I'll let you go first. What company are you pitching me today?
I am pitching Kura Sushi USA, which is actually a company that originated in Japan, as you would expect. And it was a restaurant for more than 35 years. And it grew to have more than 480 locations in Japan. And then in 2008, they established a subsidiary in California. And it's now this smallish restaurant chain in the US, but they're in this period of hyper growth, and that's why I'm interested in them. In Q1 of 2022, they had $29.8 million in revenue, which was up from $9.4 million in revenue just 1 year prior. Obviously, the pandemic impacted them, but that is growth of 154%. And they have opened 5 restaurants this year. They want to open 5 more. Yeah, I'm just very impressed with them. And the cool thing is they're that restaurant that serves the sushi on a conveyor belt. It goes around. So, idea. Are they less worried about labor concerns because they only need to have kitchen staff and not waiters? Who knows?
Dublin used to be absolutely like full of those revolver sushi places. I haven't seen one in years.
I think there's still one in Dundrum Town Centre.
No, there's not. I was there yesterday. It's not one there. Yeah. I haven't. There used to be one on every corner. Now they're all gone.
They're back.
Were you in Dundrum specifically for the conveyor belt sushi? Because you said that like you went looking for it.
I was there. I was there to pick up my broken AirPods. So now you will be able to hear me talk when
Thank
I'm walking
down God.
The street.
Thank God.
Okay, good pitch. Thanks for that, Marie. Rory, what company are you pitching me?
Well, don't call it a comeback, but I am looking at the very famous WeWork, which some people might remember from a couple of years ago. They had a little bit of trouble with the IPO that didn't quite go to plan. They are currently under a new management team. They have survived the pandemic and they are now public via a SPAC. They SPAC'd just about 6-7 months ago. So I've kind of been taking a look at them, seeing whether there's any life in the old girl. It's like, you know, WeWork was one of those weird things where it was actually not a very bad business. It was kind of right on the cusp of kind of changing trends, and they had, you know, they expanded pretty rapidly. But obviously there was an awful lot of problems with the CEO and the corporate culture. And that's, I mean, they've basically tried to clear that out now, and the business is back to kind of growing revenue. They've got some, you know, basic idea of when they might be profitable, which who knows, we'll see what happens. But yeah, that's what I've been kind of looking into.
Okay, well, as much as I like sushi, I cannot resist digging more into WeWork. Sorry about that, Anne-Marie. So let's go with WeWork.
Excellent.
So if you're not listening to Stock Club in the My Wall Street app, this is where we're going to leave you today. If you want to find out more about WeWork and what we think of it as a potential investment, however, jump on over to the My Wall Street app now and you can listen to the rest of our conversation in full for free. Remember, if you have any questions you'd like answered or elevator pitches you'd like us to tackle, make sure to get in touch. You can find us on Twitter, as always, that's at My Wall Street HQ, on TikTok, that's at My Wall Street, or simply just email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. If you're enjoying the show, make sure to tell your friends about us, and please leave a review or a rating for us on whatever platform you listen to us on. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll talk to you next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.